Are you tired of working with generic IT providers that rely on you to be the expert? Arc IT goes beyond just fixing your tech headaches. They specialize in proactive IT management, BIM support, and data security for architecture firms. The team at Arc IT gets your tech so you can focus on doing your best work. Whether you're a small firm of 10 or a growing practice with 50 or more employees, unleash the full potential of your creative vision with Arc IT. Visit getarcit.com and schedule your free IT assessment today. This is Spaces Podcast, where we aim to elevate the appreciation and understanding of the spaces we occupy every day. Hello, my name is Demetrius. This is Michelle.
Hey, everyone.
And this is Jason.
Good morning, guys.
And you are listening to Spaces Podcast. Welcome back, everyone. Thank you for joining us again. Today we're talking, how do I explain this? So we're talking about urban parks, and we're also going to feature specifically Santiago Metropolitan Park. And then we're going to talk a little bit about another project called East River Waterfront. We have a guest in that's going to talk a little more specifically about that. But to kick this off, I wanted to start with you, Michelle. You brought this to my attention. I've never been there to Santiago Metropolitan Park. You have been. So you want to kind of kick this conversation off and tell us a little bit about your experience and when you went there and why you thought it was a good project to bring up for us to talk about.
So one of the really neat things about the Metropolitan Park is, in many ways, while it is a park, it feels almost like an amusement park in terms of just all of the activities and attractions that exist. So kind of two highlights is you can actually take a funicular from the western end of the park up to San Cristobal, or to up to the statue of the Virgin Mary, which sits on the summit of San Cristobal. And that is just a really, really amazing gathering spot. There's actually a church up there. I don't know the name of the church. So even within the park, there's a church. And this statue, you can see quite literally from every corner of the park, which is really neat. And then the other attraction, which is really cool, is a cable car. And that cable car, I'm not sure exactly how long the length is, but we did take it, again, from the western end of the park to the eastern end. And it's about a 20-minute ride. It passes through different stations. You cross over a couple of swimming pools, which are, you know, again, an attraction or a public amenity within the park. You're crossing over various hiking paths and bike paths and greenery. And you're, you know, so it's just a really, really neat attraction. There's a botanical garden within the park. I mean, so there's a lot going on there, and not all tourists at all. I mean, this is a park that really, truly is being used by the community and the people of Santiago, Chile, not only just for gathering, but for, you know, use of the attractions and use of these, you know, amenities and just exercise and all of that. So I was blown away. I thought, what a cool place. And I will also say it was hot. I mean, it was very warm. We were there in February, which is their summer, kind of the dead of their summer. And despite the heat and despite the humidity, there were no shortage of people out and about and enjoying the space.
Yeah. And you visited some of the other parks, right?
Yes. Yeah, we did. I mean, it's hard to avoid. There's parks everywhere. You just walking just around the town, not only do you run into squares, which I think maybe in some cases you would call an urban park, maybe more concrete, less grass. But the park, you know, that I think I was most attracted to, aside from obviously the Metropolitan Park, just for its sheer size and just what it is, is the park that ran very linearly through the center of town, sitting on top of a freeway. I just thought that was such a great use of space, and just, you know, because it's right in the downtown, it's an amazing place that people were were literally just sitting in at all hours of the day reading books and just enjoying. So, you know, no shortage of, in such an incredibly dense city and an incredibly old city, literally no shortage of places for people to gather. And people did gather.
Yeah, so we're going to talk a little bit more about that and give some background on kind of how that park came to be, more about urban parks in general. And then we have our guest who has some familiarity with Santiago Metropolitan Park. And again, as I mentioned, we're going to talk about Project East River Waterfront. So our guest is a project director at SHOP and has played a key role in several of the firm's most important commercial, cultural, and mixed-use projects. Since joining SHOP in 2013, she has been providing the office with top-quality design in a wide range of projects, from competitions to multiple design commissions in New York City and across the globe. She has been leading the Seaport District project in New York City since 2015, a project that she has followed from concept design and public approvals to construction. She has also been involved in several tech office projects, including Atlassian's New York City offices. She graduated in architecture from the University of Lisbon, where she received the Academic Excellent Award. Please help me welcome Andrea Teixeira. Andrea, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. That's a great summary of my curriculum.
Yeah, very impressive. So is there anything that may have been left out of your bio, any hobbies or anything else you want to leave us with to talk a little bit about yourself?
The only thing left, I think it's, I just came to New York 10 years ago. Before that, I had a couple of years of work in Europe. So in a way, I think actually the two experiences have been really good, even for the subject we are talking today, have a great sense of how public spaces are around the world and the difference between, you know, dense cities like New York and other cities that are less dense and already have a kind of a heritage in place in the public domain. So that's kind of the only thing left, I would say, is that extra experience overseas.
Yeah.
That's pretty much that.
Okay. So just to kind of go back a little bit, how would you describe what an urban park is and what that difference is? Or is there a difference between an urban park and a regular park?
I would say the big difference is really that the urban park, it's connected to a fabric, a city fabric, right? Like by definition, you think of an urban park with access, or I would say even great access to the city. And it usually serves more, it's more specific to a neighborhood, meaning like it kind of, it's designed for the need of that neighborhood, generally speaking. I think though, that's really the key in comparison to other parks. I think traditional parks, it's kind of a broader term that can have, you know, can mean many things. It could be like, you know, a little square or an isolated park, but it's not really connected to a neighborhood. But definitely, I think that urban park has a very specific definition and has to deal with the connection to the city. And usually, I would say also, in terms of architecture, it differs in terms of scale. When we think about the urban park, it's usually not just that little space of landscape, you know, with two chairs and a table, but it's more than that. Usually, it's a bigger scale and has a diverse program. Some urban parks have more than others. It could be that the urban park sometimes is really just landscape and places to gather. Other parks add like retail and other programs, case of Santiago, for example, that contribute for the success of that park. But yeah, I think those three key elements are what define an urban park in general.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, before we get too far into details, I want to give our listeners a little context of how urban parks have evolved. And to do that, you gotta go back in time. It's 1840. Dark, filthy, unhygienic, and unpleasant conditions had consumed the working class, both at work and home. A committee that assembled to discuss the health of towns declared that preventative measures were required to combat the poor conditions that were arising from the rapid expansion and industrialization in urban areas. The town of Birkenhead in England had experienced an increase in population from 200 to 24,000 people in just 30 years. In 1841, Liverpool leadership suggested that Birkenhead should have a public park. Nourished by the so-called hygienist movement, which aimed to combat resulting conditions of the Industrial Revolution, leaders in Europe and the US looked to introduce areas that were intended to be places of solace, vegetation, recreation, and community engagement. In 1843, Parliament gave the Improvement Commissions authority to borrow money for the purchase of former farmland in Liverpool, England, to create a public park, which is considered the first urban park in the world designated for public use. Designed by architect Joseph Paxton, Birkenhead Park inspired countless other urban parks across the UK, Europe, and North America. Park historians have identified four major periods of urban park evolution in America: the Pleasure Ground from 1850 to 1900, the Reform Park from 1900 to 1930, the Recreation Facility from 1930 to 1965, and the Open Space System thereafter. The first model, Pleasure Ground, was typically a large park that emphasized the beauty of landscape and nature. However, the expansiveness required them to be located on the edge of the city, making it unattainable to the working class who could not afford the expensive transport to get there. The era was associated with the American landscape architect Frederick Law Olmsted, who was strongly influenced by Birkenhead Park. He and Calvert Vaux won the competition to design Central Park for the rapidly growing city of New York. From 1900 to 1930, the Reform Park era grew in response to the disparities in access to pleasure grounds. This was an effort to bring landscaping principles to urban areas, displayed in the two sub-movements of the Small Park Movement, which was introducing landscapes in smaller parks, and the Playground Movement, which advocated for safe off-street places for children to play. In addition, planners in America viewed this era as an opportunity to reform the city socially by bringing citizens together that were culturally divided through immigration. These parks were a stage to show what it meant to live in America. A large number of urban parks around the world arise from government initiatives that acquire land through a process called eminent domain, repurposing that land for the public. This process occurred in New York for Central Park, but that's a story for another episode. In Santiago, Chile, a summit that offered travelers a complete view of the valley had long been underdeveloped, heavily deforested, and its quarries were used as the main supplier for construction materials. By the late 1900s, there was a significant commitment to reforest the area, and it was promoted as the green lung of the city. On September 28, 1917, the city acquired the land and adjacent areas to create the Santiago Metropolitan Park, one of the largest urban parks in the world. At 1,785 hectares, or 4,410 acres, the park now offers a national zoo, botanical gardens, two swimming pools, cable car, funicular, which is a cable railroad on the mountainside and now designated national monument, a church, picnic areas, and a privileged view of the valley and the city. The subsequent eras of park evolution interestingly began to veer away from the emphasis on land, vegetation, and traditional landscape principles. The recreation facility era from 1930 to 1965 was about dedicated spaces for recreation, like fields and stadiums. By the mid-1960s, there was an ideology that activity can occur anywhere, and it was more about a network of spaces, Furthermore, this ideology had increasingly created opportunities for the adaptive reuse of abandoned and underutilized spaces and places. Urban parks can be a great benefit to communities, providing areas of solace, community building, recreation, nature, water storage and purification, safe routes for pedestrians and bicycle traffic, fresh air, and cooling for local temperatures. These benefits make urban parks an ever-growing priority. However, as communities increasingly contend with rising populations and urbanization, there is pressure to disregard these spaces. Considering that the world population has more than doubled over the last 50 years, from 3.68 billion in 1970 to 7.8 billion in 2020, it is imperative that we continue to incorporate them where feasible to avoid the poor conditions that we have endured in the past. You mentioned Santiago, and we talked a little bit about it in our intro, but can you talk a little bit about kind of what makes it such a special place?
Santiago, to me, it's the largest park in Latin America. So I think just by scale, there was like already an amazing opportunity there, right? It's a win as an opportunity. And then I feel that why is it successful? Well, all the program and the features that it has kind of were the ingredients for that success. If we think about the park, I mean, encourages fun because it has a lot of program from the pools. Like it has a purpose in a way for people to go there. It is cultural. Has a cultural component that brings also people there and essentially connects people to nature in a large scale. You can hike, and you can, you know, just going around, you are within, you know, the entire nature of that park. And it has great access. That cable car, I think it's really key to make people come from the city to there without having to kind of have that disconnection of like getting into a car and go to this park far away. So I think all of these ingredients are really what makes that park incredibly successful. There are others in similar in a way in other cities, like in Colombia, I can think of the park in Medellin, which is kind of similar, but I feel that it does not have the same scale and the same features that this park has. And that's to me like the key to really from what I have been reading and investigating for that park that makes that more successful than other parks.
To the comment regarding the cable car, in some ways, as it relates to connectivity, that cable car actually does literally get you from, you know, the very far west to the very far east of the city in a relatively short period of time without you having to take the freeway or the highway or side streets, which would take a lot longer. So it's almost like dual purpose. Like on the one hand, it's a gondola, really. I mean, when we say cable car, it's a personalized or individualized, you know, you can fit two to maybe six people in these little pods that are transporting above ground. So you have a phenomenal view. You're above the park. You're above the city. Because we didn't really talk about the fact that the park in and of itself is literally built on a hill. I mean, it's a giant hill, not a small hill. It's a big hill with a lot of topography. And so, you know, just in terms of connectivity, yeah, you're right. There's this connection point from east to west or west to east, or maybe it's a little more southwest to northeast if you're being really technical about it. But yeah, I mean, that amenity is dual serving in so many ways.
I think you're totally right. I know that we'll talk a little bit about what's the main feature. I think that's literally that cable car. It's because it provides you a journey. I mean, you get into the cable car. As you go, you are coming to this hill. You are going to that, like, nature, right? And if you look back, you can see the metropolitan area. Like, you're already in these minutes to the park, having a perception of the city, because multiple times, like when you don't have this happening, you just get to the entrance of a park and somebody tells you what the city is about in a bunch of maps whatsoever. In here, you are offered that perception of what the city really is and this connection into this journey of going to the park. I've been in other parks. I mean, I was talking about the one in Colombia, which we if any of you or whoever will listen had that experience of going in a cable car and actually seeing the city behind, it's pretty amazing. And I think in this specific part, it's this cable car. If we translate that, for example, for a city like New York, I think in a very micro scale, if you get to Dumbo by walking on the Brooklyn Bridge, it's a different experience than you getting, you know, an Uber and stopping at Dumbo Park. It's a special feature in a way that really makes the experience to the park be already an experience in itself, I would say.
Is it that anticipation that kind of builds and then that vantage point? Is that what you're kind of referring to, that kind of creates that experience in itself?
I think so. I mean, if we think about the parks, right? Why is a person going to a park? Why do you need that outside? It's part of human being, you know, needs in a way. I mean, we built, and especially in dense cities, in a way we had all nature back in the day. And then we built so much that the nature disappears and we just need it, right? We need to enjoy lives outside. We need to engage. We need to see people. And we need reasons, like a purpose. They're really, like, I think these parks are solving for, in a way. It's to offer people spaces to gather and to engage and, you know, in many other things, you know, all the programs that come with it, from pools to cultural buildings, just add to that, you know, need of enjoyment. So I think this access to the park, it's an extension of that enjoyment in a way. It's to me what it is. And from experience, when I went to that park in Colombia, or even like if you go to Rio de Janeiro and you go to Cristo, you have a cable car to go there. You go through the mountain all the way there just to get to the statue, being that little space, and then look out the city. I mean, it's amazing. And it's also, I think it's very interesting, like in abstract, I feel that when you go to these high hills or like platforms where you see out, you are offered a view that you'll that it's, if was not public, would only be private from a private house or whatsoever. So like, if you don't offer that to people, they're never going to get to see it. Anyway. Like a perspective of a city only comes from a viewpoint, right? So all of these components are offers to the public, to everyone, that are just places of enjoyment.
Yeah, it's like if you compare Central Park in New York City, which is very, very flat, not a lot of topography, but I would say that there are probably a lot of amenities and attractions within Central Park. But you contrast that with Santiago Metropolitan, and it's quite the opposite. And the other thing, too, is your access to the park is sort of threefold, maybe fourfold. One is you take a funicular. That gets you to one point. But you're taking a funicular because of the topography. The other is if you enter the park on the opposite end, you can pick up the cable car from the bottom, in which case your view is going up. And that's what Andrea was referencing. When we actually took the cable car, we went from the top to the bottom because we had taken the funicular up and then we went the opposite way to come down. But the other way that you can get up is quite literally walking or mountain biking or running because there's a robust trail system that winds. And I mean, we were saying you could spend an entire day from sunrise to sunset and not even begin to have seen every aspect or component of this park or experience the whole thing because it's that big.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it sounds like a place that if you have the chance, you have to get over there, right?
It's a bucket list for sure. I think I would say just from almost like a designer point of view, I think that in Santiago, what I feel is that there was a huge opportunity that was not missed. And that was incredible. Like from any point, you kept places to hike, you put program on it to even offer more like program for everyone, right? Because not everyone just wants to go every day, see a statue. So you implemented more programming to the park. To generate that fun and like a purpose for going there. And then just the access is another attraction. So I feel like it's probably the success of the park comes from there. But it's really, to me, interesting how, like, you don't have that all the time, having an opportunity and then, you know, just do not miss it and make the best out of it. And probably have, like, support from institutions or the state to make that happen. But it's incredible to see it.
Yeah. So let's switch and transition into East River Waterfront Project. Can you tell us a little bit about that project, kind of how the process went, and just in, we'll start in general with what the project is?
Mm-hmm. East River Project is the oldest, probably, project, one of the oldest that shop has, and it's still not completely finished. It's a project that has been, we started in 2004. It was a master plan, pretty much just as a summary. Like, it comes from Pier 11, where you take the ferries today, goes up to Pier 35, which we completed the piece of right now. The big idea for that space was really connecting the city to the water. So the city was, that portion of the city was, you know, a piece of industrial buildings that were not in great shape. We didn't have any east-west connection. So meaning all the streets would just, like, stop at the FDR, these elevated car paths, for whoever is not from New York. So the big idea first was really to connecting, like, east-west, to let the streets, like, come. If you walk on any street on the financial district, you would come down and arrive at the park and be at the water, which at the moment was not possible because of a lot of obstructions under the FDR and also at the water, old buildings. And then connect, also make a pedestrian path that would allow people to come from, you know, very south from Pier 11 up to Pier 35. That was the big idea. Then, you know, there was a first phase of the project that went first, which is really what we call East River in a way, which is from Pier 11 to Pier 15. Mostly were landscape and places to gather. And with special moments, especially at the intersection of streets. So today, if you walk from Wall Street, you have kind of a get down, like a special moment where people can stop and be almost at the water. And similar with Pier 15, for example, where we took a profit of having a pier there and make a sort of a pavilion with more public space on top, maximizing the spaces for landscaping together. And also started to generate some spaces for retail and restaurants. So there's two restaurants in there. And it's also where people now take some tourism boats from that pier. And then the phase two was Pier 17, already with a client. It was not just a public space, but we were not just designing for the city. We had a developer, Howard Hughes, that were really doing that project. If anyone remember where Pier 17 was before, it was really a shopping mall that obstructs any pedestrian path to anywhere. I actually remember when I came my first time in New York, I wanted to take a picture close to the Brooklyn Bridge, and I arrived to Pier 17 and, like, was completely like a building that would obstruct any views to anywhere. It was like, I remember actually to think, what a missed opportunity, and felt that this is unbelievable. This is so rich, you know. Would never imagine that years later I would be working on that. Anyways, but it was the same idea, even though we worked with the developer to have, you know, some retail space and also offices above that, and a huge rooftop for concerts and other events. We kept the same idea of making a very porous ground floor where you can walk. It's public. Everybody can walk on it and cross east, west, north, south. Which is sort of a extension of that pedestrian network overall. And then the last phase that we are pretty much finishing right now was the reconstruction of an existing historical building called the Tin Building, which by many reasons was in its previous position, really tucked under the FDR. The big idea there was to reconstruct the building and setting it back to allow for that pedestrian network from south to north to pass through, really amplifying the paths for people to walk around the seaport. So it was really overall, after a lot of work, I think the success of it is that we could really redesign the public realm around that portion of the city that's, it's so emblematic and so important. It's one of the main views, one of the probably the best real estate that you have in New York City, in a way, next to the Brooklyn Bridge. And I think the success really passes through what we offer to the public, to the people. It's well connected. The riverfront is it's a pedestrian path that people can stay, gather. It's also really large in scale. So we think it's successful by the addition of this public realm in New York City.
Yeah. So it started as, if I'm understanding correctly, it started as a city-funded and directed project, right, for the master plan?
Yes, until Pier 15, it was literally a city project that took forever to be approved. Yeah. It's also, without going too technical here, is incredibly hard to build in the water because any pier, any addition of platform, literally where you can build on top, even if it's for a park, is incredibly expensive because you got to do piles, you know, in the water. And that's a project in itself. And unfortunately, in that part of the city, those piles, those platforms were incredibly deteriorated. So they needed to be rebuilt. But it was funded. It was done. It was actually the reason why Pier 15, became a pavilion, became like elevated because the first idea was to generate a larger pier for people to gather and then it was too expensive. So we just did it. Okay. So we'll do it on, we extend it on top and actually offer some revenue for the city by having these retail spaces. But yeah, up to that part was purely public. And then Pier 17 and the building I was telling you behind was what was had a lease and was developed by a developer. Still with a lot of engagement with the city because there are plenty of parts of the site that are completely public and remain public. So it's a semi-public, semi-private project, I would call it.
Okay. What would you say was the most complex part of dealing with East River Waterfront? And then kind of expanding on that, maybe what's the most complex part about an urban park in general?
I would say that just generally speaking, the most, these projects are tougher because you are working with public land. So by itself, just by being public and not being private, you already need to engage with way more entities, go through a completely different city approval process. So way more processes, like double, triple than any other project you have. And then, you know, the number of those really depends where your site is. East River was incredibly complicated, and I'll explain why. I think from a design perspective, by the fact that, like, the questions you got to ask to develop that design are really related for, you know, the demands or the needs of everyone in a city and not a very specific niche. So design-wise, you kind of need to have a broader range of like questions you got to solve for. And then in terms of the process itself, how you make the process go through, how you build, you actually get to build that, it's complex by the amount of approvals that you got to have. I'll give you a quick summary for the East River or the seaport. I mean, it's a project that the site itself belongs to the city. Then the area under the FDR belongs to state. So you need city approval, state approval. Then portion of the site is within the historical district. You need the approval from LPC, which is the Landmarks Commission. And you have a historical building on the site. So you need approval from SHPO, who is the, you know, the entity that approves the building in itself. And because you need to connect with public transportation, which I think is the key part of any urban park. it must be connected with public transportation, and which can be like kids off the ferries or buses or bike lanes, absolutely important in pedestrian network. You need to change, roads and the paths that were there before. So you need approval from city planning. Beyond, DOBs of this world and everything else that it's just, normal for any other project. So that adds complexity.
I think you deserve a medal just for going through all of that. I mean, that sounds scary as it is. Usually you're dealing with a couple of them.
I know. Well, Pier 15, I think it took only, and it's a little pavilion in a way if you think about it, took, I think, 8 years to be approved. I was not part of it, but equally to Pier 17. I mean, I have been at SHOP for 7 years, have been working on that until now. But yeah, but like, you need all of that. And I would say that, as you said, it is really tough. So why would you be on it? Why would you fight for so many things, right? I think because the outcome is that you change a portion of the city, like your design is going to be, is going to add quality for the life of million people and is going to be part of the fabric of a city. And by the fact that it's an urban park and it's well designed, hopefully all the parks are well designed and serves all of these purposes, is going to stay there forever. I mean, even like if you think about it, like back in the day, plazas, coliseums, everything that was done in other eras was done with the purpose of serving the public. Or, for example, you have a big plaza because back in the day, didn't have internet, didn't have anything. If you needed to do an announcement for people to understand what was going on in the city, or if war was coming, you needed the space for people to be there in large, So in a way, the actual, like the contemporary translation of what that was back in the day is really that, like it needs to serve like million people. And if you design for that, you're really changing or improving the quality of life of that people in comparison to any condo tower residential project that will only change the people within the building, even a cultural project. You are giving an experience usually for people that visit the building and then go out. That's why usually the successful museums, for example, and nowadays I can point a few, always tend to try to make like a plaza or an arrival where people are not just coming in and out of a building, but actually stay there and contemplate and have a place together. So even within the like a small site, that comes from the purpose of not just getting an experience of somebody within a box, right? Doesn't matter how beautiful, how amazing that box is. So I think that that makes those projects way more worth. That's the key of us, like, really like, let's get through this and let's get the best out of it. But it's complex. It's complex for those reasons, the city approvals. And also I think that you need to work very much with everyone throughout the process, builders included, because of all of these, like, step-by-step approvals in order to get that through. But it's very worth it, I think. It's amazing to now, like after all the... I don't want to call it pain, but like after all of the hard work, for example, for Pier 17, then going to a concert in that rooftop and tell me that it was not worth it. Like you're looking at Brooklyn Bridge. It's not windy because it's not on the top of a tower. It's amazing. And it's New York. And I think that you really feel like you really changed something in a city, significant.
So I just realized that I had mentioned earlier on this show that I'd been to the Santiago Metropolitan Park. We've discussed that. But I also just realized that a month prior to me going to the Santiago Metropolitan Park, I had been to Pier 17. I was in New York in January of 2019, so a little over a year ago, and we stumbled across sort of not on purpose, but we found ourselves on the riverfront. We had been at Dumbo earlier in the morning. We took a ferry from Dumbo across, and then we were sort of just exploring. Now, it was the second week in January, and it was, I think 20 degrees outside, so yes. Very, very cold. Pier 17, it has an ice skating rink on the roof.
Yeah, they have summer and winter programs.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
In the winter,
So one of the, I guess maybe a question for you, because what I did notice, and I don't know if it was because it was seasonal, but it appeared that there was still a lot of growth and leasing to be had in the Pier 17 building. I mean, it wasn't a ghost town. There were a lot of people there, and we actually had a small bite and I think we had a hot toddy or something at the little restaurant mm-hmm. next to the ice rink on the rooftop, and mm-hmm. we were looking out over the Brooklyn Bridge. But I do remember thinking, well, I wonder who owns this, and I wonder what the lease-up is like, because it seemed like there were still quite a few vacancies mm-hmm. within the space. Mm-hmm. So maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, I think there is still some leasing to be done. It's recent, right? Like I think that the roof was really what kind of opened first, because it was already there, was completely done. And there were a lot of leasing spaces still to be done on the ground floor in that like kind of village of retail. More of those spaces have been leased right now. So, you know, they will progress and have more of those open. And I think like it will be easier to see like once that's open, and also the building that it's under construction in front of it is completed. That's when really that portion is going to work as a integrated retail space from the financial district to the water. That has to deal with leasing things from normal from a developer. They opened what they could. And also there was an intent of, even though they were still working on those spaces, to let the pedestrian path be open so people could already circulate within that. So if you see, like, try it as much as possible to, like, just cover and block what they need to make those spaces, to finalize those spaces and let the pedestrian go through. So that's ongoing and will be, you know, I believe, I mean, I don't know now with the COVID what's going to happen, but probably this year, if you pass by, you'll see there is way more stores open than before.
Well, I don't know, you had me at ice rink, so I'm in.
That's for the winter. I mean, what can you do in New York? You can't really be outside in a rooftop. So, yeah, there's some program for children to go there. I mean, a good place for ice rink, I would say.
Also, highly impressed by how, you know, the landscapers and developers put together these massive parks and I mean, just the amount of stuff that goes into them, from all the irrigation and the plumbing and the, I mean, just everything. And then not only that, being on the water, so having to build with retaining and, you know, pumps all over the place, I'm sure, and all those other kind of things. It's really cool.
Yeah, I could be here for hours to tell you how you bring services to a building in the water. And far away from land. So if it, just as a, like, very short story, all your services really kind of stop at South Street, right? The last street before the water. And these buildings, especially Pier 17, are far out, are beyond FDR. So just the amount of like thinking and approvals needed for these odd, exceptional condition, because in a lot of approvals, if anyone went through it, usually it's like a checkbox, like, all right, you need this much feet from the street, all done, compliant, whatever. And you are constantly working in exception, right? And time passes, and it's money, and there's a lot of complexity within that. And also, like, everything goes, it's in the water. It's really like you're creating an interstitial space that otherwise would be in land, completely new. And we're super restricted because you can't really build too much in that specific site. Like the heights are restricted by, you know, envelope rules, zoning. And that was a project in itself, I have to say. That sometimes is boring, but you always need to think about, if you don't go through that and you make that happen, then you don't have any building. So you got to do it. But
I mean, it's crazy, because when you think about like all the stuff that's normally under the infrastructure, you got compaction and everything else you're dealing with. For the most part, the stuff doesn't move, right? But then you take something out through the water and you got cabling and suspension, underwater welding, you know, all these other kind of things that go along with it. And you're not dealing with something that maybe shakes a little bit or could possibly go this way. It's constantly under a flow tension of this. And it's just, it's a whole nother world. That
but I think it's amazing that that was not a give up, you know, that there still is an opportunity and people, there was a developer thinking that way and make that happen, because in this specific site in New York, more than others, more even than Domino, for example, Park or even Dumbo, I think it was very a shame for a city like New York to not have that being improved and given to people was really a part of the city that I have to say more than other parts of the city was in need for this project to happen and for these spaces to occur and be given to the financial district, to be honest. Like without it, now it's easy to see it, but if anyone remembers what it was before, it was really like a missed opportunity, I would say.
I mean,
and I think that's why politicians also in community with a lot of backing for it, but was welcoming these spaces to happen.
I mean, Dee, think of construction from this standpoint. You know, you look at it like we deal with the SWEPS program out here, and we think that's such a difficult deal because you're talking with, you know, stormwater runoff and those types of things, right? There's no runoff here. You make a mistake and it's like in there. So the different restrictions and programs and stuff that are, you know, dealing with Coastal Commission and everything else, like it's that level times 100. And that's what I'm saying. Like I get frustrated enough with, you know, BMPs around those types of things. It's like, I can't even imagine like being like constructing inside of it. I mean, it's a whole nother expertise that most of us would never be exposed to.
Did you guys have to bring in a special consultant to manage that infrastructure part who is that?
Yeah. So, I mean, the biggest difference is that, as I was saying, the pier itself, so like everything below the building, it's a project in itself.
Yeah.
So we had a structural engineer, Langen, mm-hmm. and Langen and others, was not just a few others, but specifically to design that pier and design, you know, the movement of the pier and understand how you could accommodate for all those services within water. So we had in the different projects a specific consultant for that portion of the project.
I guess I'm curious, was there some sort of like special like maritime kind of water specific engineer that had to be brought in?
Engineers for the reason why we had the specific engineer for that pier was not just because of structure,
yeah,
or loads, was because they are they have a lot of expertise with maritime projects.
Okay.
Yeah. So they design structures within water. They
okay.
have more expertise for that. Otherwise, you would have the same structural engineer for the building. So not only that's a project in itself, as obviously, as you can imagine, adds more time and management in terms of coordination of multiple consultants with multiple expertises and you know, generating a lot of like problems to solve in many ways. And we're kind of like the coordinators for that, but it's essential because otherwise, like, you don't really know, you don't have confidence that you know what you're dealing with,
yeah.
in a way.
Got it.
And in a very specific way, like what they do is like beyond having expertise on knowing how deep the piles need to be. Like they have a lot of data they are based on, in terms of water tides, you know, the soil you're putting your piles on, the movements, etc. So they will give you that knowledge for the project. Yeah.
Gotcha. Now, kind of thinking about just general society, what societal changes that we're going through now or any changes that you've noticed will sort of affect the future of urban parks?
Societal changes really come from a need, right? And it's in a way our job to solve for that need. And the need that they have today is really what's going to dictate that project in the future. In a way, we are like solving for the future in terms of how we design it. So in a way, if I speak about what's now, I'm really like telling what's going to happen in the future in a way. I think definitely broadly speaking, there is this demand for connection, like connection to nature, connection to the city you live in, and being connected overall, which will going to generate the quality of the city that you live in. I don't think that back in the day you could see people so like in need of these nature and public spaces. I think cities evolve quite much in terms of construction and real estate, but these public spaces in a way were sort of forgotten And there were a lot of opportunities out there, especially for coastal cities. You see the case of New York. See how many parks were built over, what, last 6 years? East River, High Line was finished, Dumbo, Domino. And this is not just like a trend. It comes from a need of, we need spaces for people to gather. And this has happened also in Europe. In a lot of old, there's actually European funds for a lot of, especially old cities and in coastal cities, I would say, turn your cities to the water, provide more spaces for people. Generally speaking, I think there is that demand, more even from neighborhoods or like residential, you know, for the inhabitants of any city. In a larger scale, and maybe because I have been working a lot with tech companies for the past 3-4 years, there is also a political intent, or even I would say a financial intent, to make cities better just so they attract certain companies to come there. Hmm. In case of the tech companies, which is not all the companies, but they are massive, they have a lot of people, right? Anytime they look at like opening offices, etc., they look at the quality of the city they're gonna have their offices at. And purely from the fact that with the remote work that they have, people can work from anywhere. So how do you convince people to go to a city rather than the other? And there is one aspect that has been on the table on developing certain projects. And I think that I know that certain cities are seeing these public spaces and also infrastructure and public transportation, like the connectivity that ultimately generates your quality of life in the city, as one of the factors to make a city attractive and bring out the type of companies to that city. And obviously with that, you generate a lot of, you know, revenue, jobs, and, you know, your economy of that city is higher. So ultimately, the quality of public spaces is a demand from people. It's something that people are looking into. I think the technology and the fact that we can work remotely or work from anywhere in comparison to our past, we are, you know, we move around very easily. Like, it's not difficult today to a family from New York get a job in, I don't know, Europe, Australia, whatever it is, and just go if you can offer, you know, a great quality of life, not just the salary you're going to make. Like, people are actually taking into account where they're going to live. And I think that, and I know that cities have that as the public spaces are kind of linked to that demand currently, and cities want, politicians of cities want cities to be more attractive because there's a competition out there, actually.
Yeah.
So I think that that's like probably number one factor. Like, we have a higher demand for quality of life in a city, and therefore we need to solve for that need. And these public spaces are somehow what's going to define that quality of life. I think in cities, actually, and I don't know if you guys agree with that, but I was not born in a dense city. And when I was working in Europe, working in Brussels, working in Copenhagen, those are not like super high dense cities in comparison to New York. And also we have great residences. So funny enough, I studied in Porto Estrela in Barcelona. When I left these two cities, South European cities, where you have, you know, usually have a great apartment, I mean, in comparison to New York, and I went, and it's coastal cities too. So actually you go more to the beach rather than to a park, you know, to have fun or like do a picnic with people. And then I moved firstly to Brussels, and everybody goes to a park. And you barely have sun. So when you have sun, you just get your bike and you go to a park, and like it's packed. It's like London, right? So I started to understand what an urban park really does for a city, because the only place, if it's not a coastal city and it's not near the beach, that you can go to gather with people, and you need that. So even from experience, these public spaces are key to make the quality of life of a city really be, you know, in a high standard.
You know? I think that's key, right? Because like you're talking about when people are in a really densely packed area, they have a craving for A, to be open and free, if you will. So these free spaces and open spaces provide that, but also provide a gathering place to be social. Because if you're in a densely, you know, packed area, there's no gatherings to be social. And so you're kind of combining the two needs at that point. And it's kind of funny on the timing of this because of, you know, a lot of these cities that we're talking about where they are so densely packed, you know, now with everything that we're going through with the recent, you know, COVID thing. I know, dude, we're still in the middle of it too, right? People just aren't looking at it. But with the recent COVID thing, there's a lot of question as to whether people are now going to start avoiding densely packed areas and wanting to get back to, you know, suburban type lifestyle. And then, you know, but in a suburban area, which is more where I am, you have open space and backyards and all these other kind of things. So, but you still need the social piece. So is it the social people coming to your home? Is it still going to some other open areas? You know, what is that? But yeah, I mean, you know, Chicago, New York, San Francisco, all those other kind of places, you're right. You see these parks and they're just packed with people because they need to get away from the rigidity of, you know, normal day life.
I would say that in New York, I mean, and it's really a scale of like what you get with your residents in a way. Like generally speaking, in New York, these parks are your courtyard, are your balcony. You don't have that in apartments, generally speaking, right? So then if we start to think, and with the COVID, I think like we get a lot of these questions and we do a lot of like gatherings with clients, et cetera. What's going to change? Yeah. In a building scale, I can tell you what's going to change, more or less like filter air, like naturally ventilation. Well, clap your hands that people are understanding those things are needed. And the future proof of a building, it is not a glass box. Because if you have a glass box, you are dependent on mechanical systems and you probably are not able in a COVID time to have 10 people in your office. So welcome naturally ventilation if you can. But in an urban scale, I think is really providing more of these spaces. Because in a city like New York, I mean, in a practical way, the fact that you cannot get outside and you need to be at home means in New York that you barely have natural air, you know, for quite a lot of time.
Yeah.
So these parks, you see Domino, I think it was amazing when they put the circles and like let people go there as long as you are in the circle and not too cool. Like, you know, the distance is I don't know if you guys saw, but like they did on the grass, they made some circles.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Everybody knows, well, if I'm in my circle, I'm in a right distance from each other. Anyways, imagine that we have a great amount of spaces like that, that would have relieved so many inhabitants of New York and you know, not get to the extreme of being all day at home, you know, and have no way to get out. So more of these spaces, I think, is the answer for the future, and better of them and accessible to people.
Yeah, the other part of today's social climate that I wanted to mention and kind of get your thoughts on is this conversation that's finally starting to arise about disenfranchised communities and their lack of access to certain elements, or these type of parks not being introduced in those communities. Any conversations that are starting to arise within SHOP or that you're just hearing on that front?
I think that there's two things in two aspects of it. One, it's, you know, if you do have these spaces and you're just focused on how do I connect better to the other low income or whatever other parts of the city that do not have as direct access to it. And I think that in a case of New York, for example, making these parks near the water, have like public transportation to those, you know, in bike lanes, linking everything up. I think it's in the bike lanes that were done, for example, on the west side of Manhattan, where you can really come from like, you know, Harlem down, were key for that. But I do think, and this is less related with architecture in itself, but more related with, you know, politics in the city, I do think that we should look and invest in the same quality of spaces in areas that are that do not have any of these spaces nearby. So it's not just like saying, like, you know, you have a problem of all of these neighborhoods and you get them connected to spaces that are, you know, great, welcoming. But if there was a look and an investment on neighborhoods that are not functioning, that are not, that don't provide any type of public spaces, that actually, even by not providing those, are less safe. Because if you have a park, I'll give you an example. It's having public space under that FDR by default was not very welcoming. It's like you don't feel safe because you have shade. You like feel you are going through like a dark space, etc. So by investing on making that space better, you welcome people to go there, and automatically it transform from a, like an unsafe to a safe place to stay, and people go there to do sports, etc. These happen in a very prime part of the city connected to financial district. If there was a program or an investment, a special investment of doing this in neighborhoods that are not of high income, understanding that maybe you're not going to just generate a lot of revenue or bring a niche of the society there, but you are improving the quality of spaces of that neighborhood, I think it would be key, especially in a city like New York, that it's a rich city. Like there is probably a lot of money out there if there is an intent to improve those areas. That I would say that, for example, a little example of that, it's Pier 35 that we just finished. Still not in the most low income parts of the city, but it's near a neighborhood that it's and has low income, and it kind of serves more that neighborhood that the Pier 15, etc., that it's connected to financial district. I do think that should be almost like a project in itself. So it's not about like finding an opportunity and, okay, this is a great location. There is a site here that we can do something with, and we're going to generate an urban park, but be specific to those neighborhoods and engage with community. That's one of the things that in New York occurs, doesn't occur in many other cities in the world. Another approval we needed to have was community board, by the way. And it was sometimes the hardest, it was hard, but it was good for us to understand what were the needs, you know, and you better understand what that neighborhood, what actually the people from there really wants out of that public space. But to respond to your question, I think that's most likely, if you are building spaces like this near a low income, it's not going to be done by a developer, because the developer is not going to build anything there. It's going to probably need to be subsidized, or, you know, be a project made by the city, the government, the state, whatsoever. And it should be a project in itself, I think.
Yeah, it's definitely going to require city and state investment to improve different areas. Everyone's so afraid to invest in communities because they think it's going to get damaged by the bad actors, bad characters. But I think more often than not, the good people outweigh the bad and will defend a good quality space against other people. And when you have people that are actively involved in that space, if it's a well-designed space and they want to be there, it's not some, like you mentioned, covered in shade and kind of that sort of shadowy place, people will be there. And if it's occupied, then there's no chance for someone to do something bad.
And I would say people are the activators of the space. Yeah. Look at East River, the portion of East River that it's not in financial district. So Pier 35 and then a portion of the FDR that it still will still need to be developed, like link Pier 17 to Pier 35. But around Pier 35, which connects to a different fabric, city fabric, you see the people from that community, and they are not in high income kind of communities, activating that space. Mm-hmm. Majority of the time, they are the ones that are there. And if you see it, it's safe when you have people there, right? It's less safe when you feel like a place that has no one there, kind of don't feel like going. And it's exactly to your point, like they will activate the space and probably be way more there than, you know, the high income, let's say, neighborhoods where you probably just go there on the weekend. You know, if there's some kind of retail or coffee shops, you will go, but you're not activating the space like almost like 24/7. Like you don't exercise, for example, outside. Everybody's exercising in the East River, especially near that kind of neighborhoods, not like the financial district people that has a gym in the tower, you know. So just in a practical way that serves more that those neighborhoods, as I was saying, like the kind of the backyard of your apartment, rather than, you know, the high income communities that go more for a walk and, you know, recreation.
Yeah. One last question to wrap up. What's one thing that designers, builders, developers, anybody that you think would be appropriate, what's one thing to consider when approaching an urban park?
I would say engagement, like being working as a team, I think it would be key. If you're not talking about the specific like design aspect of it, but you must work with the same goal and as a team to get these things through. Otherwise, it does not happen. Even developers would give up if there is not a strong team pushing these things through, because it's extremely hard. It takes twice or triple the time to be implemented. And I think that you really need key people, from designers to builders to, you know, politicians, to work as a team throughout to make these projects happen.
Yeah, great point. Thank you so much, Andrea.
You have such a great perspective. That was awesome.
Thank you.
That's all for this episode, but keep listening for a sneak peek of our next episode. This show is part of the Gable Media Network. You can check out similar content at gablemedia.com. That's GABLmedia.com. You can help support what we're doing here by leaving a 5-star rating and a review on your preferred podcasting app. It helps others find us, and your support is the only way that this show grows. And don't forget to connect with us through our Facebook community, Instagram, and see the random thoughts and articles that we share on Twitter and LinkedIn. But before you go, next time on Spaces Podcast.
My wife and I went to a show at the Whiting Theater, and I remember using the bathroom at the intermission, and this was right at the beginning of all this. So I turned on the faucet at the theater, and it's just like blowing, just running brown, like super brown, rusty water. And I was, it's like, wow, that's crazy to think about. And that was really the eye-opening kind of beginning.
And thank you again for spending some time with us. Talk soon.
Calling all AEC professionals. Get ready for unparalleled professional insights with Detailed, an original podcast by RCAT. This is the podcast that brings you the untold stories and lessons learned behind the design and delivery of a building project. Hey, it's Charisse Lakeside, aka the CSI Kraken, and your host. Join me as we dive deep into the tales of conflict, triumph, and sheer ingenuity.
Yeah, so when Serena was named for the, it was going to be named for the building, you know, we really were able to work with teams at Nike Branding and how to really infuse her influence and identity in the very public spaces.
Detailed features architects, engineers, builders, and manufacturers who spill the beans on the most complex, interesting, and downright odd building conditions they've encountered.
Another challenge of the shuttle is actually putting it in launch position is how you brace that seismically. It's really supported by only two pins at the base of the booster rockets. And there's a large base isolator that's underneath the shuttle that kind of prevents it from moving too much in an earthquake.
When you have 600 people or 300 people in a room, acoustically, you really need a high floor to floor so that you can have the right acoustic environment for people to be able to talk, and that speech intelligibility is really good.
Every episode unveils lessons learned and connects you to the products you need to navigate similar challenges. Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Detailed today and be prepared for the unexpected on your next project. Every building has a story, and we are here to tell it.